Thank you, Faith, and welcome everybody to this Bitter Information webcast for the upcoming BGS Basic Generation Service statewide auction process. I have with me today two colleagues, Rachel Northcutt and Paul Cardona, who will help me provide some of the content for this presentation. And we also have with us representatives from the EDCs to help answer your questions. As Faith mentioned, we take questions in writing through the WebEx interface. You can locate the Q&A on the right-hand side of your screen, select all panelists in the Ask box, type in your questions, and click Send. To the extent we can, if we have questions that we can answer as we go, we'll do that. Otherwise, we'll consider your questions at the end of the presentation and answer, as time permits, any questions in answer that we provide on this webcast will also be posted to the website as an FAQ. The presentation today will cover briefly the roles for the auction manager, the EDCs, board staff, and so on in the auction process. And we'll then talk about an overview of the board decision. The EDCs filed their BGS auction proposal in July, and the board rendered a decision on November 18th. So we'll provide an overview of the main aspects of that decision and highlight the consequences for the supplier master agreements of that decision. I'll then turn it over to Rachel to talk about the timeline, the BGS website, and the application process. And given that nothing is business as usual in these pandemic times, there have been adjustments to the application process that we'll be discussing today and adjustments to the entire auction process that we'll highlight for you throughout this presentation. Paul will then talk about the details of the auction rules and an overview of the bidding procedures. As Faith mentioned, myself, Chantal Lacasse, and Paul and Rachel are from NERA, who serves as auction manager administering the statewide auction process for basic generation service customers. The EDCs, or electric distribution companies, that is PSE&G, Public Service Electric and Gas, JCP&L, Jersey Central Power and Light, ACE, Atlantic City Electric, and RICO, Rockland Electric, are responsible for the elements of the proposal. Board staff and their advisors are consulted on the auction parameters that are used throughout, and the board advisor monitors the auction process and advises the board. The board has committed to rendering a decision on the auction results, on the results of the two auctions that we'll be discussing today within two business days. Once the auction results are approved by the board, then they are binding on bidders and on the EDCs. The next section talks about the board decision. And before talking about the elements of that decision, we'll just do a little bit of looking back at the events that have occurred from this point. The regulatory proceeding that led to this decision in November began in March 2020 when the board issued an order asking the EDCs and any other parties to submit proposal on how to procure supply for BGS customers in the state. The EDCs filed their proposals on July 1 for a statewide BGS auction process. The regulatory proceeding that followed included discovery, two rounds of written comments, as well as a legislative type hearing last September. The board rendered its decision at its regular agenda meeting on November 18, 2020. And this decision is memorialized in a board order that's posted to the BGS auction website. I'll talk about a couple of the elements of the proposal of the EDCs. So I said at a very general level that the EDCs proposed a statewide auction process. The EDCs proposed one substantive change to the BGS product, namely to remove transmission from the BGS product. This has followed a lot of discussion in prior proceedings regarding transmission, and the board order approving last year's auction, so the 2020 BGS auction, specifically called for parties to work to resolve the disparity in timing between BGS supplier payment to BGM for transmission costs and receipt of payments for such costs from the EDCs. Following this call from the board, the EDCs have proposed that the EDCs, rather than the BGS supplier, be responsible going forward for transmission and transmission-related costs. Sorry, Rachel, can you come back to the prior slide, please? So this proposal would be for June 2021 going forward, that is that the removal of transmission from the BGS product is proposed as part of 2021 BGS supplier master agreement. The EDCs also propose to give each current BGS supplier the option to remove transmission from any existing BGS contract. So this is also looking forward, starting at some date after approval of the compliance filing by the board, but would address all of the existing contracts, so the two-thirds of the BGS RSCP load, as well as existing CIEP contracts. In a separate proceeding, the board has considered a potential mechanism for the release of the collect don't pay amounts or the tracked amounts under the former Section 15.9 of the BGS Supplier Master Agreement. And although we'll not be talking about that in any detail today, the board did approve a mechanism by which suppliers can provide a letter credit for 50% of the tracked amounts, and we provided those tracked amount by the EDC subject to certain conditions. That was one element of the proposal. A second element of the proposal that I'll highlight here is that the EDCs proposed that capacity proxy prices be in place for the 22-23 as well as the 23-24 delivery year. That's similar to a feature of the supplier master agreement for the BGS RSCP auction from last year. And that feature was because in the 2020 BGS RSCP auction, the actual capacity price for the 22-23 delivery year would not be known before the auction. And that was because of changes to the capacity market in PJM and a delayed approval and resolution of those matters before the FERC. At that time, for last auction, the board approved the use of a capacity proxy price for that delivery year, and that would mean that there would be a true-up mechanism by which the BGS RSCP supplier would pay or would be paid the difference between the rate actually paid by that suppliers for capacity and the capacity proxy price for the 22-23 delivery year. So this year, that situation continues in that the 22-23 base residual auction, 23-24 base residual auction will not have occurred prior to the next BGS RSCP auction. When the July filing was provided to the board, we didn't know the timing exactly. Now we do know that the timing, for example, for the 2223 is May with results in June 2021. So it is certain, absolutely certain at this point, that neither of those base residual auction results will be available in time for the BGS RSCP auction. The EDCs for that contingency proposed setting two sets of capacity proxy prices, one for the 22-23 delivery year and one for the 23-24 delivery year. And again, same mechanism as last year to true up the rate actually paid for capacity by the supplier to the capacity proxy price for each of those two delivery years. the board, in considering the auction proposals and the filing made by the EDCs in July, did approve both of those specific proposals, namely the removal of transmission from the obligations of suppliers and the transfer of that obligation to the EDC, as well as the setting of capacity proxy prices for those two delivery years and the true-up mechanism that I described. More generally, the board approved other elements of the proposal, for example, that there would be two auctions that are part of the statewide auction process, the BGS CIEP auction for large commercial and industrial customers, CIEP for commercial and industrial energy pricing, and one for residential and small commercial customers, or BGS RSCP for residential small commercial pricing. There's a statewide auction process, meaning that the applications and most of the events for both auctions occur at the same time, and the application of suppliers are separate for each of the two auctions, but can be done through one form and one process. It also means that within the auction, offers for all the BGS load not already procured is solicited through one process. The auction format is maintained from prior years as a clock auction, which is a multi-round and multi-product design that we'll be describing in more detail later on in the presentation. The supply periods have not changed from prior years, being 1 year for CIEP and 3 years for RSTP. As in prior years, the EDCs requested and the board agreed that it would consider the results of both auctions within two business days of the close of the last auction. The board in its decision also directed that there should be additional training in the wake of COVID-19. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, we are expecting that the auction manager, board staff, the board consultant, and some or all bidders will not necessarily be at their normal place of business during the auctions, because there can be connectivity challenges associated with a work-from-home environment. The board directed that there be additional training and opportunities for trial auctions to practice the bidding procedures. Accordingly, this year, bidders will be able to attend a webcast regarding the auction software and the bidding procedure in the January timeframe. We'll go over those dates a little later in the presentation. And that follows past practice. Participate in two trial auctions, so one more trial auction than had been the case, for example, last year, so that if there is a bidder that has difficulty in the first trial auction, they have a second opportunity to make sure that any issues that had been uncovered can be solved prior to the auction beginning. And finally, there's going to be a Q&A session a couple of days prior to the beginning of the BGS CIEP auction, where bidders can have access to technical assistance by phone and ask any questions regarding the procedures that they may still have, or if there are still issues that continue after the two trial auctions, that they have another opportunity to resolve any of those issues before the start of the auction. So while we're on the topic of changes in the wake of COVID-19, the work-from-home environment, I'll kind of stray a little bit from talking about the board decision to talk about additional changes that have become necessary given the new environment. And this relates to how we would accept various documents that bidders will be submitting with the Part 1 and Part 2 applications. And as I mentioned, Rachel will go into much more detail here, but just to highlight that while the process used to be for wet signatures and wet signatures that were notarized to be submitted to us through the application process, we will be accepting digital signatures. By digital signature, I mean a signature that's produced by a commercially available software such as DocuSign 1 and 2 that is accompanied by an additional document or information that allows the BGS auction manager to verify the identity of the signatory. So we will allow digital signatures on all documents that are submitted with the Part 1 or the Part 2 application. In certain circumstances, and as I said, we'll provide the full details later on the presentation, bidders can also use electronic signatures. So I'm making the difference here between a digital signature that's produced by commercially available software and an electronic signature, meaning, for example, an image of your actual web signatures. These distinction and these details will be provided through this presentation. There's also documents that are available for you through the application website that are available on the sidebar of the Part 1, online Part 1 application form that also provide guidance, including the Part 1 application review process. There is a specific document that provides instructions for downloading and those additional documents or information that verifies the identity of the signatory that is also available for you on the sidebar. And in addition, each insert, so each additional form that's in Word format that you are required to provide with the Part 1 or the Part 2 application has its own set of instructions on it on how it can be completed and submitted. All that being said, if you have specific concerns related to COVID-19, the work from home environment and the BGS auctions, and at the end of the presentation, you think that we have not addressed that particular concern, please send your comments to us at bgs-auction@nira.com. So that was just to highlight a little bit changes to the process that are coming up and that we'll be talking about in more detail. Going back to the board decision and the next step in the regulatory proceeding, the EDCs will be making a compliance filing, so a filing of documents to comply with the order from the board, and that compliance filing is due tomorrow on the 4th, at which point documents for the compliance from the compliance filing will be posted to our website, bgs-auction.com. Once those documents have been approved by the board, then they will become the governing documents for the auction, and I'll name the following governing documents here: the supplier master agreements, or SMAs, the BGS RSCP supplier master agreement, BGS CIP supplier master agreement, the auction rules, which are going to be titled final BGS RSCP auction rules and final BGS CIP auction rules, each EDC's company-specific addendum that provides various details on cost recovery and on rate design, as well as the board order that I have been referring to from November 18, 2020, and docket ER20030190. Having those governing documents here, I'll say now that any statements that we make through this presentation will make statements that describe or that refer to these governing documents, and those statements are summaries only, and they're qualified in their entirety by my reference here to the governing documents. In this next session, I'll talk about the BGS product, following up on the change to the BGS product to remove transmission, and talking about various provisions of the BGS supplier master agreement, not in specific order, but highlighting some of the key features of the supplier master agreement. As I mentioned, the EDCs will be responsible for payment of transmission-related costs to PJM going forward, and that's integrated into the 2021 BGS RSCP and BGS CIEP master agreement. Each of those master agreements has an appendix that lists all of the PJM billing line items, and that has a specific table that shows those PJM billing line items that will be transferred from the BGS supplier to the EDC. And those line items are the ones, and that table is the one that's provided on this slide. the fact that the responsibility for transmission has been transferred from the supplier to the EDCs as meant that there's other changes to the SMA that had to occur for that to happen. In particular, the whole mechanism of the old Section 15.9 that would track changes to the transmission rate and modify the payment to the supplier after a final FERC order, that entire mechanism in 15.9 and some in Section 4.3 was deleted from the agreement. The responsibility for transmission that is now on the EDC that's memorialized in Section 2.2, modifying the section on the obligation of the parties, and that section refers and tracks the PJM billing line items from the sample PJM invoice that we were just discussing. Other various modifications were necessary, for example, for the BGF CIP supplier master agreement, there is a separate payment for transmission, and that separate payment was removed. And there's also a new section 15.9 that states that the parties will agree to make conforming changes to supplier master agreement if changes occur to the PJM agreements that would affect the PJM billing line items in question. Notwithstanding the fact that now the transmission has been removed from the BGS product, BGS product remains a full requirements product, by which we now mean that the BGS supplier is responsible for supplying energy, capacity, ancillary services, and any other service that may be required for PJM to meet its share of the needs of BGS customers. As we mentioned, there are two different agreements, BGS-CIP, BGS-RSCP. The responsibilities of the supplier under those two agreements are the same. However, the payment terms are different. There is a all-in price, cents per kilowatt hour, for the BGS-RSCP supplier agreement, and as we'll see in later slides, there are various components of the payment for the BGS-CIP supplier, including a separate payment for energy capacity, and so on. The BGS supplier is also responsible for meeting the renewable portfolio standards, and the next few slides address that specific requirement or responsibility. BGS suppliers under the supplier master agreement will transfer RECs, Class 1, Class 2 RECs, and solar renewable energy credits, or SRECs, to the EDCs, and for that purpose have to have a retail LSC account in PJM GAAP. While the BGS suppliers will transfer those RECs and SRECs, the EDCs do take the responsibility to submit the required annual compliance report on behalf of BGS suppliers. A supplier that would not be able to meet these requirements by transferring RECs would instead have to pay an alternative compliance payment. Just a reminder, because this is not specifically new, that the solar obligations under the Clean Energy Act mean that some BGS contracts, namely the BGS contracts that were executed prior to the enactment of the Act, which was in May 2018, are exempt from the increased solar percentage requirement. Now, for those BGS contracts that do not have to provide for the increase in solar requirements, that increase in solar requirement that's avoided by those exempt BGS contracts in the given energy year are then allocated to non-exempt BGS contracts in the following two energy years. So for example, the increased solar obligation avoided by exempt BGS contracts in 2021 is made up by non-exempt BGS contracts in energy year 2022 and 2023, where the energy year 2021 means that it ends on May 31st, 2021 and begins on June of the prior year. Now, at some point, this will end. That is, all of the exempt contract will not only have terminated, but their follow-through effects of increased solar obligations on current contracts will end, and that will end starting with energy year 2024. We have made in the past available to bidders an example of the calculations of these obligations and of the increased solar obligation that are avoided by exempt BGS contracts, and we'll make one available again this year. And that example will also show that any fulfillment of solar obligation for non-exempt BGS contracts are also counted towards the Class 1 requirement. Aside from transmission, we mentioned the capacity proxy prices that were approved by the board. So let me provide a little bit more detail about that. So this is because the PJM-based residual auction for both the 22-23 and 23-24 delivery years will not occur prior to the auction, occurring instead for 2023 in the May-June 2021 timeframe, and for 2024 in the December 2021 timeframe. So the table on this slide provides the capacity proxy prices that will be used and that were filed in the July filing and approved by the board. There are two. So one is for PSE&G, so they're 162.13, 166.64, and all the other EDCs, so JCP&L, ACE, and RICO, have a slightly different capacity proxy price. The true-up mechanism that we discussed previously will be applied separately for each of those two delivery years, and in the BGS RSCP supplier master agreement, this is memorialized with two different supplements that deal with the change in the payments to account for the capacity proxy price for each of the two delivery years. Similarly, the rates for customers will be adjusted for these additional amounts either paid to or received from the BGS RSCP suppliers. And from the point of view of the supplier invoice, this will be a separate line item in each of those two delivery years. I'll provide a brief overview of the credit provisions for the BGS supplier master agreements. For both RSTP and CIEP, the credit provisions are in Article 6 of the Supplier Master Agreement, and that article fully describes the credit worthiness standard under the Supplier Master Agreement and the security that's required. For BGS CIEP, it's fairly simple. The security required is a credit exposure of $70,000 per tranche, so fixed amount per tranche. For RSTP, there are two separate requirements. There is also a fixed amount per tranche that's called the independent credit requirement, and that's $2.4 million per tranche at the beginning of the agreement, but that amount does decline over the term of the agreement. There are two separate requirements for BGS RSTP, but there's also two separate credit lines, so two separate opportunities for a supplier or its guarantor to obtain unsecured credit. One is for the mark-to-market requirement, which was the second of the separate credit requirements, and one is for the independent credit requirement. So more precisely, the credit line for the market-to-market exposure under the BGS RSCP Supplier Master Agreement aggregates all of the exposure under all of the BGS RSCP SMAs held by that supplier, and also aggregates under the same exposure, the BGS CIEP credit exposure of $70,000 per tranche. The second potential credit line is specifically to address the requirement of the independent credit requirement that begins at $2.4 million per tranche. I'll close with a couple of reminders regarding the supplier master agreement. The first is that their changes are possible during the three-year period that would affect BGS RSCP suppliers. And I'm concentrating on BGS RSCP suppliers here because of the three-year supply period here. So first, The rate design that is approved by the board is approved on a yearly basis, so it's always possible that the rate design will change and will affect switching behavior by customers. There's also changes to renewable portfolio standard that could occur and changes to the levels for the alternative compliance payment, and also changes to the CIP line, that is, at which customer size is a customer required, if they do take BGS, to do so on a CIP tariff or rate. So that has been stable for the last 2 years, but it's not outside the realm of possibility that that would change, and this is a risk that BGS or STP suppliers do take. The second reminder is that the supplier master agreements that will be filed and comply with the board order tomorrow will become the standard statewide supplier master agreements, will have been approved by the board. And as a condition of participating in the auction, applicants have to agree to these standard terms. Also approved as part of these standard terms are a standard form of guarantee that's appended to the supplier master agreement, as well as a standard form for a letter of credit that can be used to post security during the term of the BGS supplier master agreement. Now, the letter of credit, there was a comment process that occurred in the September-October timeframe where suppliers could propose modification to the letter of credit appended to the supplier master agreement, and that process has closed, but the EDCs have approved modifications to that letter of credit that can be used on an optional basis. Next, we'll talk about various key announcements that have occurred already, as well as provide a little bit more of an overview of the BGS auction process. At this point, we've concentrated on talking about the product and talking about various provisions of the supplier master agreement. So we'll give a little bit of an overview of other aspects of the BGS auction process. As I mentioned, there's a single statewide auction process, so it's one process that is used for both of the two auctions, the BGS CIP auction for larger commercial industrial customers, as well as the RSCP auction. For the BGS CIP auction, the auction is going to determine what's called the CIP price, which is a dollar per megawatt day, and suppliers are paid that CIP price determined at the auction on the basis of the capacity obligation of BGS CIP customers. Suppliers are paid for energy at the real-time hourly spot price and are also paid a predetermined rate for ancillary services. Suppliers are also paid the CIP standby fee. So the CIP standby fee, the difference between that payment component and the other payment component is that the CIP standby fee is levied on all CIP customers, so on customers that do take BGS CIP and on customers that take service from a third-party supplier, but if they were to come back to BGS, would have to do so on a CIP tariff or rate. For the BGS RSCP auction for residential and smaller commercial customers, the auction, as I mentioned, determines an all-in price in cents per kilowatt hour, and suppliers are paid this price for every kilowatt hour of load served times the seasonal factor, but the seasonal factor at this point is equal to one. So we've been talking about the difference between CIP and RSCP customers. This is just to provide a little more detail on that. So there are certain rate classes that are CIEP rate classes that are provided in the first column here for each of the four EDCs. And in other rate classes, it's kind of a mix of CIEP and RSCP customers. So customers in those rate classes are CIEP customers, so have to take BGS on a CIEP tariff or rate if there are at or over 500 kW. That being said, a non-residential RSCP customer can opt in to CIP, so can opt in to have an hourly price type service. And to do that, the customer must notify the EDC by the second business day in January. There are no switching restrictions here, so BGS customers are free to come and go from BGS, provided that they give the appropriate notice to the EDCs. We have on the BGS auction website a data room that has various data series that we'll describe a little later on, but in particular, it has data on switching, so you can find more detail on that in the data room of the BGS auction website. We announced on November 20th the minimum and maximum starting prices for the BGS CIEP auction at 500 megawatt day for the minimum and $650 megawatt day for the maximum. And what that means is that in the first round of the auction, so as we'll explain later, the auction is a multiple round process where the price gradually goes down until the amount bid is equal to the amount that's needed. So those prices in round one of the auction will be selected between the minimum starting price and the maximum starting price, so between the $500 and the $650 per megawatt day. The other announcement that was made on November 20th is to provide the number of tranches as well as the peak load share after the PJM November update, and correspondingly the tranche size as a percentage of load serve and the megawatt measure. So the percentage is the true size of the tranche. So for ACE, for example, with four tranches, then the tranche size is 25%, meaning that a supplier that wins one of those tranches will be serving 25% of all the needs of BGS CIEP customers at any point in time. The megawatt measure is provided for informational purposes only and is based on the eligible load, not on the load that's actually on the service. So it includes all the customers that are currently served by third-party suppliers, but that could come back to BGS. So we've discussed this a little bit already, and this slide provides the components of the rates for CIEP customers and the components of the payments for BGS CIEP suppliers. And as we mentioned, for CIEP, there are various components, both for the payments and for the rates paid. So for both of these, the energy is an hourly real-time spot price. The answerly service, I said it was at a fixed rate, and that fixed rate was proposed and approved by the board at $6 per megawatt hour. The capacity is paid on the basis of the capacity obligations of customers and is paid at the price determined through the BGS CIEP auction for that particular EDC. Finally, the CIEP standby fee is paid not only by the BGS CIEP customers, but also by CPS customers that, if they were taking BGS, would do so on a CIEP tariff or rate. And that CIEP standby fee of 0.015 cents per kilowatt hour is on the basis of the CIEP's customers' usage at the customer meter. I'll talk about these same announcements and highlights on the BGS RSCP side. On November 20th, we announced the minimum starting price and maximum starting price. And the minimum starting price this year is 9 cents per kilowatt hour, and the maximum is 12 cents per kilowatt hour. We also announced the RSCP peak load shares for this year based on the PJM updates and the number of tranches that you see here, as well as the load caps. So the statewide load cap for the BGS RSCP auction is 21 tranches. That's the maximum on the number of tranches that any bidder can bid and win through the auction. There's also a statewide load cap for the BGS CIEP auction that I did not mention a couple of slides ago, that was 18 tranches. for RSCP, there's not only a statewide load cap. There's only a statewide load cap for CIP. For RSCP, not only is there a statewide load cap, but there are also load caps for each of the EDCs. So there's a maximum number of tranches that a supplier can bid and win separately for each of the EDCs, and what you see in the middle column of, for example, 14 tranches for PSCNG. As was the case for CIP, a tranche is really measured as a fixed percentage of BGS RSCP load. So for RICO, for example, that has four tranches in total, one of which is up at auction this year, then each tranche is 25%, meaning the supplier that wins a tranche for RICO supplies 25% of the full requirements for all customers at any given point in time. Again, the megawatt measure here is provided for information purposes only and is based on the RSCP peak load share, meaning on the eligible load, including all customers that currently take service from third-party suppliers. It's roughly 100 megawatts on an eligible basis. In terms of the payments and the pricing for RSCP, we've already gone over the fact that the auction determines all-in cents per kilowatt hour. So in this example here for 2021, for strictly for ease of mathematical computation, we took a price of 10 cents per kilowatt hour. The payment to suppliers is, in theory, that price that's determined in the auction times a seasonal factor. So assuming a seasonal factor of 1.0284 would provide a price paid to the supplier on 10.284. Now, I said in theory because in practice, at least the provisional seasonal factors as of right now are all one, so that suppliers are effectively paid this cents per kilowatt hour determined through the auction for every kilowatt of load served. From the point of view of the customer, given that there is one-third of the RSCP load at auction each year at any given point in time, customers are served by suppliers that have won at three different auctions. So starting in June 2021, customers would be served by suppliers that have won in the 2019, 2020, and 2021 auction. So the rates for customers then will depend on the averages of those three auctions that are tranche-weighted and are also seasonally adjusted. So in the example that we have here, that tranche-weighted average price with seasonal adjustment could be, for example, 7.890 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's at the system overall level to determine the rate for a particular class, then that average price is multiplied by a given factor that represents how the class compares to the overall average. So here in the example that we have here, that factor is 1.1015, meaning that whatever rate class we're looking at is a little more expensive to serve than the average would be. So the multiplication of that factor with the average price seasonally adjusted provides for the rates for customers, in this case for summer. Another component of the proposal that we mentioned already is the clock auction. It's a multi-product design, meaning that for each auction, the RSCP or the CIP, the tranches for all EDCs are procured at once. And it's also a multiple round design, so that in round one, the price that will be stated to suppliers will be a price for each EDC between the minimum and the maximum starting prices that were announced on November 20th. And at those prices, suppliers are going to state how many tranches they want to supply at those prices. To the extent that there are more tranches that are bid for an EDC than are needed, then the price for that EDC will tick down. And that's why it's called a clock auction. And in a subsequent round with those lower prices, suppliers are again going to be invited to bid in stating how many tranches they want to supply at those new prices suggested by the auction manager. in so doing, suppliers will be able in some circumstances to switch their bids from one EDC to another. That's always within a given auction. So just RSCP switching from one EDC to another, or within CIP switching from one EDC to another. And this process will continue and prices will gradually come down until the amount bid is equal to the amount that is needed, at which point final auction prices will be determined and the auction will end. Those prices, again, are slightly in different measurements for RSCP and CIP, being the all-in price in cents per kilowatt hour for RSCP and the price in dollars per megawatt day paid on the basis of the capacity obligation for CIP. As we mentioned, the board has accepted to render a decision on the auction results within 2 business days from the close of the last auction. I'll just give a little more detail about that. That kind of assumes that the board considers the results of both auctions together. It doesn't need to do that. So the board could consider, for example, the result of the BGS CIP auction first and consider the BGS RSCP auction results at a different time. The results for each auction are considered separately, but they're considered in their entirety. So that means that if the board approves the results, for example, for the BGS RSCP auction, then it would approve the results for all of the EDCs. So it's possible that the results for the BGS RSCP auction are approved, but the results for the CIP auction are not. But it's not possible to approve the results for some EDC for a given auction and not others. And that concludes the section on the overview of the proposal. I'll now turn it over to Rachel to talk about the timeline and the BGS website.
Thank you, Chantal. In this next section, I'll review the auction timeline going forward, and then I'll provide some useful information about the BGS auction websites, as well as provide greater detail on the application requirements to participate in the auction. I'll start here by highlighting some key upcoming events. So first, it's important to note that the process for applying to participate in the auctions is a two-step process in which applicants submit a Part 1 application followed by a Part 2 application. The Part 1 application became available this week, and the Part 1 materials are due by 12 p.m. on December 15th. The auction manager will then notify applicants who have completed all requirements of the Part 1 application that they are now qualified bidders and that they may submit a Part 2 application, which is due by January 14th. Qualified bidders that complete all requirements of the Part 2 application will become registered bidders. And as we discussed, this year, registered bidders will be able to participate in 2 trial auctions to allow bidders multiple opportunities to practice submitting bids using the auction software. The first trial is scheduled to occur on January 28th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And the second will be held on February 2nd, also from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The auction manager will also confirm participation with each registered bidder ahead of time. And the actual auctions will then begin on Friday, February 5th, for CIEP bidders, and on Monday, February 8th, for RSCP bidders. Some additional important dates to note, the auction manager will provide bidders with the starting prices for the BGS CIEP auction on February 2nd and the starting prices for the BGS RSCP auction on February 3rd. The auction manager will also provide the tranche fees, final seasonal factors, and post the final rate spreadsheets on January 26th, and then provide the final decrements on January 27th. I'll next offer some information surrounding the BGS website and then the application site. So the BGS auction website serves as a central source of information for bidders. information is organized by page, and pages are grouped together under different tabs. The Bidder Info tab houses the pages that contain the auction rules as well as the Supplier Master Agreement. And bidders should also refer to the Contract and Credit page that's also located under the Bidder Info tab. And here, bidders will find the standard forms of the pre-auction letters of credit, as well as other credit documents that may be required as part of a bidder's application to participate in the auction. Now, bidders access both the Part 1 and Part 2 applications on a different website, and that application website is bgs-application.com. Bidders who have already requested login credentials and bidders that have participated in previous BGS auctions should have received their login credentials to access the application on this past Tuesday, December 1st. And if you believe that you should have received this information but did not receive it, please contact us at bgs-auction@nira.com. If you're still in need of login credentials, you can request them on the homepage of the application website, as well as on the Get Info tab. And after clicking on the link to request an account, applicants will be prompted to provide their name, company name, and an email address to receive the credentials. The auction manager will then provide you with a username and password to access the online Part 1 application form, as well as a set of instructions for its completion. And after logging in, a number of additional tabs will appear on the application website. Bidders should click on the Part 1 application tab to access the form and should navigate to the Inserts tab to download a number of additional documents that are completed with the application. In this next section, I'll review some of the requirements of the Part 1 and Part 2 applications. The applications are each submitted using separate online forms. An applicant should fill in the online forms and complete and upload any required supporting documents as needed. And some of the documents that you'll be required to provide with the application form are called inserts, and these are separate Microsoft Word files. And I'll provide additional information on how to complete different types of inserts later in this presentation. This slide provides an overview of the Part 1 application requirements and lists some of the information that you'll need to provide in the online Part 1 application form. The first four sections of the form collect contact information for the bidder and a number of representatives. So here a bidder will be asked to designate a bidder team, and that will consist of an authorized representative as well as additional nominees. And these individuals are authorized to act on behalf of the applicant and will be copied on all correspondence from the auction manager. In these first sections, the bidder will also name a legal representative in New Jersey, and this can be an entity or an individual who accepts service or process on the applicant's behalf. Additionally, the bidder will name a credit representative who may answer any questions about the applicant's financial information. Now, BGS suppliers are required to be or to become load-serving entities in PJM, and in Section 5 of the online form, bidders who are not already load-serving entities will need to certify that nothing impedes their ability to becoming one by the start of the supply period. You'll also need to provide financial information and supporting documents for the applicant, as well as for a guarantor if you intend to rely on the financial standing of a guarantor. This information includes financial statements and credit ratings. And this information will then be used to determine a creditworthiness assessment for the bidder, and in turn also determines what a bidder will need to provide as pre-auction security with its Part 2 application. And then the last few sections of the Part 1 application will require the bidder to indicate whether it's applying to participate in the RSCP or CIEP auction or in both auctions. And then the bidder will be required to make a number of certifications agreeing to the auction rules and to the terms of the supplier master agreement. As I mentioned earlier, the form will prompt you to provide a number of inserts. And again, these are Microsoft Word documents that will require a signature. These files are available on the Inserts tab of the application website and are organized into different categories specific to each auction. Bidders should download the inserts that correspond to the auction in which that bidder is applying to participate. But please note that all bidders, regardless of which auction you're applying for, will need to download the zip file containing inserts 1 to 5. So for example, if you're applying to participate in only the RSCP auction, you should download the zip file containing inserts 1 to 5, as well as the zip file containing inserts 6 to 8. And there will be an appendix at the end of this posted version of the presentation that will list which bidder should download which inserts. So please refer to those slides after the presentation has been posted if you're unsure of which inserts you'll need to include with your application. Now, inserts may be signed and completed in a number of ways, and each insert will include some additional instructions for its completion. Some inserts may be completed with a digital signature, other inserts can be completed with an electronic signature. And what we mean here, a digital signature is a signature that is created using a commercially available software such as DocuSign that generates an additional document or information that can be used to verify the identity of the signatory. A digital signature is different from an electronic signature. What we mean by an electronic signature is one that is not created using a software that generates additional information that can be used to verify the identity of the signatory. So an image of a signature is an example of an electronic signature. Each insert will fall into one of two categories based on the acceptable types of signatures that can be used to complete that insert. Inserts such as the authorized representative insert can either be signed with the signature notarized, or then this insert can be completed using a digital signature. And in this case, the bidder must also provide accompanying documentation or information that can be used to verify the identity of the signatory. Also note here that if you complete an insert using a digital signature, then the insert is not required to be notarized. Then to submit an insert completed in either of these ways, you can upload the insert to the online application form, or you can email the insert to the auction manager directly at bgs-auction@nira.com. Now, inserts such as the nominee insert can be completed in 3 different ways. You can complete this insert with a digital signature and provide the additional information to verify the identity of the signatory. And in this case, you can either upload the insert to the online form or email the insert to the auction manager. But you can also complete this insert with a scanned wet signature, or you can complete the insert using an electronic signature. But note that if you complete an insert using an electronic signature or a scanned wet signature, this insert must be emailed to the auction manager directly, and it should be emailed either by the signatory or with the signatory on copy. And again, there are instructions at the top of each insert that describe the acceptable methods of completion for that particular insert. And we've also made available an additional document that's accessible through the online application that provides further information on digital signatures. And I'll point out here that it is acceptable to complete all required inserts using digital signatures if you choose to use that single method. This slide illustrates generally how the form functions, and you'll see the application form includes text boxes and clickable radio buttons that, depending on your answer, will trigger additional sections of the form to appear. There's also a sidebar on the right-hand side of the form that contains some useful information like a glossary, a document describing the application review process and timelines, and some general instructions for completing the form. And this sidebar is also where you'll find that document that provides further information on digital signatures. So you can then save the form as you go and log out to finish it at a later time. But when you are ready for the auction manager to review your application, please hit the submit button. And once you've submitted the form, you should receive an email confirming that the form was received, and you'll also be temporarily locked out of your account while the auction manager reviews the submitted information. The auction manager will provide a notice with a review of the application materials by 6 p.m. on the same day that the form is submitted, if the form is received by 12 p.m. that day. If the form was submitted after 12 p.m., a notice is provided by 12 p.m. on the following business day. And these notices are sent to the bidder team. And again, that's the authorized representative and any nominees. If the application materials are complete, the bidder team will receive a notice confirming that no further information regarding the Part 1 application is required of the bidder. But if the auction manager requires clarification and the materials are found to be deficient, the auction manager will send a notice requiring a response from the bidder to cure the deficiencies by either 12 p.m. on the Part 1 date, which is December 15th, or by 6 p.m. on the next business day, whichever comes later. And if a bidder's Part 1 application is deemed complete, the bidder will receive a notification of qualification. And this will contain the creditworthiness assessment and provide instructions for the required pre-auction security that's due with a bidder's Part 2 application. So only bidders that receive a notification of qualification will be able to submit a Part 2 application. And the Part 2 application is completed online, and it will become accessible after the window to submit Part 1 materials closes. And the Part 2 application functions similarly to the Part 1 application, with enterable fields for text and upload spots for any required supporting documentation. In the Part 2 application, bidders will need to confirm the contact information for the authorized representative and also confirm the auctions in which the bidder is applying to participate. For each auction in which the bidder intends to participate, the bidder will need to provide an indicative offer, provide the information needed to prepare the supplier master agreements, as well as make some additional certifications regarding compliance with the association and confidential information rules. And bidders will also need to provide pre-auction security. Please note here that the pre-auction security must be sent electronically by email to the auction manager at bgs-auction@nira.com, and hard copies of any pre-auction security should not be sent. Now here I'll give a bit more information about the indicative offer, and this is the maximum number of tranches that the bidder is willing to bid across all four EDCs at the minimum starting price, and the maximum number of tranches a bidder is willing to bid across all four EDCs at the maximum starting price. For each auction, the indicative offer at the maximum starting price determines the maximum number of tranches that the bidder can bid in that auction. And the indicative offer also determines the amount of pre-auction security that a bidder must submit with its Part 2 application. And in addition to providing an indicative offer, RSCP bidders will also need to provide a preliminary interest in each EDC at the minimum and maximum starting prices. And these values are provided for each EDC separately, and they're purely informative. Also, it should be noted that CIEP bidders must submit an indicative offer at the maximum starting price of at least two tranches. Pre-auction security is provided for each auction separately, such that bidders applying to participate in both the RSCP and CIEP auctions must submit pre-auction security for each auction. And again, pre-auction security should only be sent by email to the auction manager at bgs-auction@nira.com. For BGS CIEP bidders, the pre-auction security is a letter of credit in an amount of $375,000 per tranche of that bidder's indicative offer at the maximum starting price. BGS RSCP bidders are also required to provide a letter of credit as pre-option security, but in an amount equal to $500,000 per tranche of that bidder's indicative offer at the maximum starting price. And additionally, the results of an RSCP bidder's creditworthiness assessment may state that the bidder is required to provide additional pre-option security if, one, that bidder is relying on the financial standing of a guarantor, in which case the bidder will be required to provide a letter of intent to provide a guarantee, or two, if the bidder or the bidder's guarantor does not have sufficient unsecured credit, in which case the bidder will be required to provide a letter of reference from a bank. And again, this creditworthiness assessment will be provided with a bidder's notification of qualification. So the pre-auction letter of credit for each auction must be in the standard form of the electronic pre-auction letter of credit for that auction. But bidders can incorporate a number of changes and modifications to the letters of credit that have been deemed acceptable by the EDCs on an optional basis. And the standard forms of the electronic pre-auction letters of credit, as well as the list of acceptable modifications, is available on the contract and credit page of the BGS auction website under the bidder info tab. And just a note here that the terms of the RSCP and CIEP electronic pre-auction letters of credit are the same, but each one references the corresponding auction rules and supplier master agreements. So you must use the letter of credit that corresponds to the auction in which you're applying to participate. Now, just like with the Part 1 application, once you submit the Part 2 application, you should receive an email confirming receipt of the submission, and you'll be temporarily locked out of your account. The auction manager will send a notice either stating that the Part 2 materials are complete or that the materials are deficient. And the response time for bidders responding to a deficiency notice for the Part 2 application is the same as for the Part 1 application, except for pre-auction security. The pre-auction security is reviewed by the auction manager and a committee of representatives of the EDCs, and the review may be provided in a separate notice to the bidder, and it may not necessarily be provided at the same time as the notice provided to the bidder about the other Part 2 materials. And with that, I'll hand things over to Paul, who will provide further information on the auction rules, as well as provide greater detail surrounding the procedures for bidding in the auctions.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Chantal. As Rachel mentioned, I will be talking about the auction rules as well as the bidding procedures in the 2021 BGS auctions. So as Chantal mentioned, if I can change the slides, the BGS auctions proceed in a multi-round process. So I'll be going into what a bid looks like in round one, what a bid looks like in round two and all subsequent rounds, and how those differ. So a bid is a number of tranches bid for an EDC for which a bidder is willing and ready to supply for a given auction. So in our example, a bidder is willing to and ready to supply 10 tranches to PSE&G, 4 tranches to JCU-P&L, 2 tranches to ACE, and 1 tranche to RICO. You'll note here that the bid is only an offer for supply. You do not specify a price. You will submit your offers for supply at the price stated by the auction manager. There are 2 rules surrounding your bid in round one. The first is determined with the pre-auction security that you submitted with your Part 2 application that Rachel just talked about. The pre-auction security, as Rachel mentioned, will determine your initial eligibility, and you will not be able to bid more than this initial eligibility in round one. As Chantal also mentioned, the announced statewide load caps and load caps from November 20th, there's also specific limits on the number of tranches that you can bid in the BGS RSCP auction, and those are load caps that are applicable to each in the EDC individually. Once bidders submit their bid, the round will move into a calculating phase where the auction manager will calculate the results, and then we'll move into a reporting phase. And when we get to the reporting phase of round one, bidders will be provided with certain information regarding the general process or general results from that round, as well as their own bid. With respect to the auction generally, they'll be given a range of total excess supply. An excess supply is the sum of offers for supply in excess of the aggregate tranche target for the EDCs. What you'll receive in your common report is a range that will include the actual excess supply, but it will not actually include the excess supply itself. So in our example on the table on the left, the actual range of excess supply falls somewhere between 151 and 155 tranches inclusive. At the start of the auction, the range of excess supply is narrow. So in our example, the range is 5 tranches. However, as we get closer to the close of an auction, the range is somewhat larger. Bidders will also see the prices for round two, as well as information specific to their own bid. And it's important to note that the information you receive about your own bid is specific to you. You will never see anything about other people's bids, their identities, or eligibilities. And the same is true for them. They will not see anything about your bids, your identity, or your eligibility. Again, as Chantal mentioned earlier in the presentation, the prices tick down between rounds. So that means that they decrease from round to round. And a price decreases if and only if there are more tranches bid for an EDC than the tranche target for that price after that round. So that's to say that the supply, the offers for supply are greater than the demand for an EDC for that round. At the start of the auction, prices tick down in larger decrements than they do toward the end of the auction. There are three main regimes for decrement formulas. At the beginning of the auction, we'll be in regime one. Once certain parameters are passed, you'll move to regime two. And once you get close to the end of the auction, we'll move to regime three, where the range of possible decrements falls between 0.25% and 2.5%. Final decrement formulas will be made available to bidders and finalized upon successful completion of the Part 2 application and the registration of bidders. Like I said before, there are slight differences between the way in which bidding occurs in round one versus how bidding proceeds in round two and all subsequent rounds of the auctions. There are sort of four main actions that are available to bidders when bidding in round two and beyond. The first action is relatively simple. A bidder can keep the number of tranches it bid the same for each EDC as it bid in round one. There are no constraints with respect to that type of bid. The other three types of bids that can happen sort of center around the fact that the price for an EDC has ticked down. So if the price of an EDC hasn't ticked down, then these actions may not be available. Those actions are withdraw. So a bidder can remove tranches from an EDC in the auction. A bidder can switch, meaning it can reduce the number of tranches bid for one EDC or multiple EDCs and increase the tranches bid on another EDC. Finally, they can perform both of those actions simultaneously. And again, I'd like to reiterate that a bidder can only reduce the number of tranches bid on an EDC if that EDC's price has ticked down during the previous round. Just like with round one, there are rules that dictate how much a bidder can bid in aggregate in an auction, as well as for a particular product in an auction, EDC in an auction. The total number of tranches bid on all EDCs can combined cannot exceed a bidder's eligibility in round two, which is determined by the number of tranches bid in round one. This is the same in subsequent rounds. So the number of tranches bid in round three, a bidder's eligibility in round three, will be the number of tranches a bidder bid in round two. And just like in round one, the low caps are applicable in round two in all subsequent rounds, including EDC-specific low caps for the BGS RACP auction. So I'll revisit this sort of main actions that a bidder can take when submitting a bid in a round. I won't revisit just submitting the same bid. That's relatively straightforward. But I'll talk about withdrawing and switching simultaneously. So in our example here, we see that in round one, a bidder submitted offers for supply equal to 15 tranches across all four EDCs. In round two, the bidder reduced the number of tranches that it's willing to supply across all four EDCs by one tranche and now is willing to offer 14 tranches. We see that the bids for PSE&G, JCP&L, RICO all remain the same, so that one tranche is being removed from ACE. When a bidder decides to withdraw tranches from an EDC, the auction manager will ask for additional information. In particular, in this instance, we will ask for an exit price, which is a bidder's final and best offer for the tranches being removed from that EDC. There are two rules governing the range of acceptable exit prices, the first being that it has to be above the current round price. So in our example here, the exit price has to be greater than 11.328 cents per kilowatt hour. And the second rule is that it has to be below or equal to the previous round's going price. So it has to be below 11.5 cents. In our example, this bidder submitted a valid exit price, which was 11.4 cents per kilowatt hour. A bidder can also switch between EDCs or multiple EDCs. In our example, we can tell that a bidder is only switching because its offers for supply in round one, which is 12, is the same as the offers for supply in round two, which is also 12. However, unlike the previous example, we see that the mix of bids across the four EDCs is different from round one, from round two. Specifically, the bidder is electing to remove six tranches from JCP&L and transferring them to PSE&G and ACE. When a bidder reduces the tranches bid on one or more EDC, as well as increases the number of tranches bid on more than one EDC, the auction manager will ask for switching priorities. And this will be used to determine if we need to hold back tranches from switching from an EDC in order to fill the tranche target for that EDC. So in our example, a bidder could designate that they want tranches bid or switched onto ACE before tranches switched onto PSE&G if the auction manager has to deny switches to meet JCP&L's tranche target. Finally, a bidder can elect to switch and withdraw at the same time. And we can see this happening in our example because the bid mix across all four EDCs is different than in round two than in round one, and the number of tranches bid in round one, which is 10, is greater than the number of tranches bid in round two, which is 9. So when decreasing the number of tranches bid from more than one EDC and switching, the auction manager will ask for information on which tranches are being withdrawn from the auction. In our example, we would ask for designation whether we're removing tranches from JCP&L or RICO, and the bidder would specify that they're reducing the number of tranches bid on or withdrawing from JCP&L and they would be asked then to name an exit price for that tranche. Reporting will look a little bit different in round two and all subsequent rounds. And that will be based sort of on the rules governing withdrawals and switches. So the auction manager may retain tranches from exits or switches if necessary to fill the tranche targets for an EDC. And there's three levels to fill a tranche target. First, the auction manager will fill an EDC's tranche target with tranches bid at the going price. Next, the auction manager will retain exits. Finally, the auction manager will deny switches. In addition to getting information about its own bid, bidders will see information about any retained exits, including the exit price in which tranches were retained, as well as any information about denied switches, including the last price at which the tranche was freely bid. The auction continues in rounds 3, 4, and all subsequent rounds in the same manner as the procedures of round 2, and the auction finally closes when the prices for all EDCs no longer tick down. This occurs when the exit supply is zero for all EDCs. Bidding on all EDCs will stop at the same time, so if the prices for JCP&L, ACE, and RICO have stopped, but the price is still ticking down from PSENG, the auction will continue until the price stops ticking down on PSENG. Once that happens for all EDCs, all bidders will win tranches for an EDC at the same price. So if the price ends for PSENG on an exit price, all bidders will be paid that exit price. Lastly, we'll be going over the bidding procedures in the auction. Bids are submitted online using auction software. So all the procedures that I just talked about, submitting the bids, looking at your round reports, will be received from an auction software. You'll access the software with a specific login ID and password provided with the auction manager to the bidding team after the successful completion of the Part 2 application that Rachel described. And as Chantal and Rachel talked about, in light of the changing work structures due to COVID-19, bidders will have multiple opportunities to practice submitting bids using the auction software. So there'll be two trials. Again, those are January 28th, and the second will be held on February 2nd. We encourage bidders to attend these so that they can practice bidding procedures from the place in which they are planning to participate in the BGS auctions on the actual auction days themselves. Requirements are minimal, so you will be able to access the software using a standard PC as well as a supported internet browser. And details on the system requirements will be provided to bidders at a later time. Finally, just to reiterate some of the key dates that Rachel mentioned earlier in the presentation, the BGS CIP auction will be on Friday, February, will start on Friday, February 5th, 2021, and the BGS auction, RSP auction will begin on Monday, February 8th, 2021. And while the auctions do begin on different days, they may run concurrently. So if the BGS CIP auction does not finish on that Friday, it will continue and run simultaneous to the BGS RSCP auction on Monday. In response to COVID-related challenges, the auction manager expects to make rounds slightly longer for the 2021 BGS auctions than what has been the case in previous auction years. Tentative schedules will be provided with bidders in the January webcast, but actual schedules will be provided the day before the auction start. So for CIP, the schedule for Friday, February 5th will be provided on Thursday, February 4th, and the schedule for RSCP auction will be provided on Friday, February 5th. Lastly, before moving on to questions, there are pauses that can occur during the auctions. Two types of pauses are generated by bidders, and one type of pause is generated by the auction manager. So bidders have two extensions that extend the bidding phase of a round by 15 minutes. These are typically used for technical issues where you would be able to phone in or contact the auction manager team and resolve your technical problems or place a backup bid over the phone. Please note that the bidding phase in round one is automatically extended, and if a bidder requests an extension in round one or fails to submit a bid during the bidding phase, an extension will be charged to that bidder and will run concurrently with the automatic extension. This is true for all other rounds in which multiple bidders request extensions. The extensions run concurrently and do not occur or run consecutively. So if three bidders submit extensions, the bidding phase will only be extended for 15 minutes, not 45. Additionally, each bidder has one recess request to extend the reporting phase by no less than 20 minutes, and that is usually used to take extra time to consider your bid. This is only available later in the auction, after round two and after total excess supply has reached a certain threshold. And then finally, the auction manager can call timeout, for example, in the case of general technical difficulties. And we will have, we'll let you know if that is the case. With that, I'll pass the presentation back to Fate to go over the procedures for asking questions. Thank you, everyone.